Good afternoon. You're listening to KYRS. I'm Taylor. I'm your host. You're listening to Praxis. And this afternoon, I have a new interview that I took, I guess, just this past weekend. It's been a long week at the Veterans for Peace National Conference, which was here in Spokane. I met a few great people, and you'll be hearing those interviews roll out through the next month or so on the show or on the podcast, if that's how you might be listening later. This first one I'm really excited about. She's someone who I'm really glad could come here to Washington, and she'll talk about it in the interview. Her name is Loke Aloha, or Ruth Aloha, and she is indigenous Hawaiian, and she has been a big part of the resistance to the 30-meter, the so-called 30-meter telescope development at Mauna Kea, which if folks haven't heard about that, she will give a lot of context, and I'll pop back on the mic after the interview, because it's not a full-length interview, to talk a little bit more about it and share some resources that people can learn more about what's going on with this, the latest of other telescope developments that are on this sacred site. Why is the site sacred? What has the resistance looked like in the past, and what does it look like now? So I'm really excited about that interview. And then kind of continuing on a more environmental but also indigenous-led resistance front for the show, I'm going to close the hour talking about the agribusiness-generated fires in the Amazon, doing some light debunking, and also just sharing some of the reasons why that is a terrible thing that is happening, but also I guess addressing some of the narratives that have emerged from that. So it's going to be a jam-packed hour. I hope that it's a good one, and I hope that you enjoy this interview that I'll kick off with Ruth Aloha. She was just amazing to talk to, and I could have talked to her for a lot longer, but she didn't have, she was busy at the conference. So thank you to the local Veterans for Peace also for bringing her and so many other good speakers to that conference. So here is that interview for you. So I guess if you want to just start, thanks for joining me, by introducing yourself and talking a little bit about who you are, where you're from, what you do.
Okay, that sounds great. Aloha mai kako, o Ruth Aloha ko'u inoa, o mauna, a wakea ku'u mauna, o kona ku'u aina kupuna, o kaloko ku'u loko, o kona kaimalino ku'u kai. My name is Loke Aloha. My mountain that I'm calling for today is Mauna Kea on Hawaii Island in Ko Hawaii Pai Aina, known as the Hawaiian Islands. My ancestors descend from the Kona district on this island. I am a fish pond guardian, and I called forward my fish pond, which is Koloko Fish Pond, and the traditional name of our ocean, which is the Kona Kaimalino, the peaceful seas. I'm 30 years old. I am a mahu. And the work that I do engages and calls for nonviolent and peaceful interactions with land, water, ocean, and sky, and indigenous peoples and all peoples of this earth. It extends from our highest mountain peaks of Mauna Kea to the deep oceans of our Kanaloa, which is our sea god.
And so you're doing that, my understanding is, with an organization that you founded?
I work with different organizations, and so I've come forward, like one of the more formal organizations that I am the president or the po'o, like the head for. We are called Malu Aina Center for Nonviolent Education and Action. It was founded by Jim Albertini in 1979. Our roots extend from the geothermal movement in Hawaii to keep safe our lands and that heat source in the ground. We are a nonprofit, we're a food pantry, and so we provide fresh organic produce and other goods to the east side islanders, who are a lot of our own people. Kanaka Maoli, the natives who don't have access to fresh and affordable foods or food in general. But then I am also the po'o, or the head for the more grassroots fish pond group that I'm a part of, the Hui, for Koloko Fish Pond, yes.
And so it sounds like from your introduction that this is just kind of who you are, like protecting where you're from, and like it sounds like it's who you are. But what's your journey been into doing things like
like this weekend, like speaking to the Vets for Peace conference, doing more like formal organizing. What's that journey been like for you?
Yeah, and I actually, I just was actually reflecting on this, like, how did I come to live this life? Like, I would never be able to afford this, to come to Washington for a second time, to travel to New Zealand just like last month. These opportunities to share and to learn and to grow and to empower and network and weave our histories and our experiences. So I always start with my childhood. I think that's the best place for me to start, and it's a vulnerable place. And so growing up on the edge of houselessness with a single mother and knowing hunger and knowing domestic abuse and a lot of the violences that face many of us, especially Indigenous peoples or Native peoples, that's really informed every decision that I've made. And one of the biggest is being a protector for the earth and for our water, being a water protector, a mountain protector. And it's so those hardships that have taught me how to be resilient and that have taught me how to be in deep honor and appreciation of these life forces that give us life, that will have to give the next generation and the generations to come life. And so it's those experiences as a child and the teachings of my grandmother who really embodies peace that has given me this life that I live today.
Mm-hmm. And I guess for people listening, probably if they have been thinking of Mauna Kea lately, it's because of the effort to defend it from the telescope construction. Is that something that you're involved in? Can you speak to it all?
And so right now, if folks are aware, and if not, please make yourself aware if you have some time. There's numerous video clips or radio interviews or articles that have been written. And so our sacred mountain, which is our birth point of our people, the native peoples of Hawaii, Kanaka Maoli, there are many telescopes on the mountain, and there's been dissent in the history of those telescopes being built there. But now at this point, they want to put one more telescope up, and you might hear the acronym TMT, and that's the 30-meter telescope. And that is what the current standoff is today in regards to. It's to keep safe our ancestral connection, this sacred point, from the development of this telescope and the destruction, further destruction of our sacred mountain.
Mm-hmm. And I guess how does something like, I think people think of something like a telescope and they think of it as different than something like a pipeline, you know, or an oil well. But I guess how does that project fit into the colonial history of the place, and why is it something that might seem obvious, but like, why is it something that people are fighting?
Yeah, I think there's many points, and some people fall in different spectrums of like why they think this is enough and why they've had enough. And I think one of the most foundational to the center of why I stand as a Kia'i, as a mountain guardian for our sacred mountain, is because it is a birth point for our peoples. And so there's a genealogical connection, and with that genealogical connection, there is a sibling responsibility to keep safe the family. And so to stand is to keep safe a member of the family from further pain, from further hardship. And then if you're just looking at like the political scene, our people never gave consent to or gave up any of our lands or our waters. Our queen was imprisoned and the U.S. illegally occupied and continues to illegally occupy our lands. And so these lands that are going to be used, that would be used if this would go through, are lands that our people have never consented to giving to any government. They belong to our people. So there's that. But then there's also the fact that this is a sacred watershed, and so all of our mountains are connected. And so to build this telescope, they actually have to detonate bombs on the mountain of this sacred aquifer that feeds the whole island. And so the threats of that type of construction activity, combined with the fact that for our ancestors, it wasn't a space where anyone could go to. It wasn't just, we call it the Vawakua, the realm of the gods. And not just anyone could go there. There had to be strict intention and reason to go. And so the increased use of the mountain and development of the mountain and introduction of trash and human waste and harmful chemicals also threatens the integrity of the water, of the plants, of the forests. And our mountains are only as healthy as our sacred reefs, and our reefs are as healthy as our sacred mountains. And so everything starts and ends with the mountain.
Yeah, and it just seems like there's so much arrogance from the perspective of NASA. The, you know, the people who are developing this are saying, like, it's for science. Yeah. But I think that the reasons that, and this is, you know, from my outside perspective, but the reasons that the place is sacred also are scientific reasons, you know, like, yeah. There's...
Yeah, I think that's like that's a common narrative that is used to build separation and then also to create confusion, is it's a science versus culture matter. But all Indigenous people were scientists. They use the same processes and other processes to gain knowledge and insight, and it's built, you know, it's tested, like it matches with the scientific methods. And so, yeah, I always call these things false narratives. And so the Sacred Mountain, yes, we did use it to teach navigation. But yeah, we also didn't need to use destructive tools or methods in order to advance our human understanding of the elements and of navigation and so forth. And so that's definitely been a spin by the telescope, by the University of Hawaii, who supports this project. Not everyone in the university, but the president, David Lasner, by the governor of Hawaii, David Ige, and by Suzanne Case, who is the chair of our Land and Natural Resources, and they manage the waters and lands of the state.
So I guess looping all the way back to the work that you're doing now around nonviolence, what is nonviolent resistance to these kind of projects and the other destructive things that are going on look like, and what are some examples that you would lift up for folks to for inspiration or for?
Yeah, and so I think if we're looking at, I mean, a common teaching in our ways that I've learned, we call it kapu aloha, and kapu aloha it can also be simply translated as nonviolent or peaceful civic engagement or actions. And aloha is a deep, deep sense of love and compassion and empathy. And kapu it can be described as like a standard or a taboo or a way of being or a way of not being. And so the kapu aloha is a reminder of us to always be in a space of love and compassion and empathy. And if you're looking at the current standoff at the pu'u, which is the hill where they call it pu'u huluhulu, it's a movement that is built and founded in kapu aloha and peace and nonviolence. And so what does that look like? It looks like food for all. It looks like a space that is cared for, empowered, and intentionally led by ceremony and prayers and people who have connection, who have pilina, to these places like Mauna Kea. And so if you're going to the mountain, what does that mean? That means that you will be fed. You will be fed well, and that is because the community will take care of you. If you go to the mountain and you're unprepared, please don't be, but if you should go, you'll be greeted with clothing, with appropriate clothing and attire, in order to make sure that you are kept safe and cared for. You'll be greeted by medics and healers of all sorts, who are there to care for you and make sure and ensure that you are in your highest way health-wise to be there on that mountain. It'll look like elders sitting in the middle of a road for several weeks, that would do it for several lifetimes if they had to, in a peaceful stance to protect the very essence of their being. It'll look like the next generation below them and the one below them caring for them, giving them food and water and massages and keeping them dry and making sure that they're not exposed to too much sun. And it'll look like silence when the enforcers come to arrest you. It'll look like a silent body with a loud spirit that engages in peaceful ways if they should come to take you away. And if they're meeting you with the LRAD, which is this voice machine, this violent voice machine, if they should meet you with their guns or with their batons or with their riot gear and their tear gas, it looks like whisperings on the front line. This is what you're going to do. You're going to cover your nose. You're not going to breathe in. You're going to take short breaths through your mouth, and you're going to push. And we're all going to pick up who's left behind, and we're going to take them. And so there's no act or action or thought of violence. Everything, every decision, every action, every thought is founded in a place of love.
Mm-hmm. It's a really beautiful description. What, you kind of just said it, but why nonviolence, do you think, for those who, I think these last years, these last centuries really have been a story of violence and struggle against violence and all of that, but why is that?
Yeah, I actually, I think, like, you know, you can't use violent ways to teach peaceful methods. And so I think if we are all striving to create a more peaceful world, where we all could be seen and heard and respected and loved, it demands that we enter into these spaces and all spaces in a presence of the world we want to create. And that's the starting point. That's where we always start. And so that calls for peaceful, nonviolent ways of interaction, like the kapu aloha.
And so what specifically, I guess, what's your message, being here at the Veterans for Peace Conference, what's your message to the veterans who are gathered here? And what's the relationship there? I guess, obviously, you know, the place that you're from has a history mm-hmm. and a current legacy with the U.S. military and the U.S. Empire. What's your message this weekend?
I'll have many points. I'm still creating the bigger message, but I guess a message definitely is one of unity and one of solidarity, in this commitment, and in this effort, this desperate intentional effort, to create a more peaceful world, and extending an invite to the Veterans for Peace to join us on our mountain. To stand with us, or to share the message, to support us in any way that they can, and they've done so. We've had Jerry out to the mountain, and he came forward to our Kupuna Council and greeted them. And so I thank Veterans for Peace for entering into that space in such a respectful way. I know that they're also drafting a resolution of support for our people and for the protection of Mauna Kea. But it definitely is to welcome them into this space, because where we stand, we are within about a mile or 2 miles of the largest military base in the Pacific, and that's Pohakuloa. And so at every effort, the governor and those who are in power of this government are trying to make our stance seem violent, and we are not a violent people, and violence is in no part of our movement. But if anything should happen, there will be an immediate response, perhaps by the National Guard, or far worse, the actual military that that is sitting right across the street from us. And so it would be a good reminder to those individuals of, you know, and it was interesting to listen to this morning's speech, and they're talking about, you know, we are the creation of, saying something to the effect of they created, you know, the wars, and now they're trying to undo that. But these are the people that will maybe one day be joining Veterans for Peace. And to actually see Veterans for Peace who are standing of all ages, of all backgrounds, can be very powerful for people who are currently enlisted in certain branches that may have to come to the mountain. I'm not too sure. I hope that doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But just a strong stance of solidarity and peace and unity.
Mm-hmm. From people who have been where they are.
Have been where they now. Are. Yeah. And it's a, you know, as a demilitarization activist, as a lover of the earth, sometimes those discussions are hard to bridge, but I feel like that's a special place for Veterans for Peace to enter the discussion and to speak more directly to the hearts and the experiences, real experiences and trauma that current individuals who are serving perhaps have experienced or thought about, giving them a voice of courage, a voice of hope, a voice of reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the beginning, you talked about something that I definitely believe is true, particularly in regards to all the work we have to do to protect the earth right now, and kind of, not kind of, but in a very dire time. And I think, you know, indigenous people everywhere have the answers for that. Very much are the folk who know what's going on. I guess similarly to engaging the veterans, what would your thought be for people who have been separated from their indigenous past, people who have come to this land and your land and other places as settlers, as colonists, you know, colonizers, what now do you think needs to be done in terms of healing with the, like, in order to get to a point of engaging respectfully and being part of this movement toward healing?
I would say, and I can speak for, you know, for my experiences in our lands, and it works for me. I think it's appropriate, but it may not be for everyone. But enter softly, listen before you speak, learn when to speak, learn how to speak, learn how to sit. So it's a lot of observation. It requires you to slow down. It requires you to take a step back from perhaps spaces of privilege that you've been given, or that you don't even know that you have. It's to allow the indigenous people to speak, and to be heard, and to lead, and to support them, and to not judge them. I don't think this can apply to everyone, but if they have the ability, know where you come from, know who you are, even if you don't know or have a living or feel like you have a living connection to your ancestors or the lands that you come from, know them, minimally know them. Know those names, know the names of your families, because when you come, you still arrive with them. You're still arriving with the people who have raised you, or the lands or the waters that you know. So know where you have a connection to, and enter with a space of knowing where you come from. Because it's not about race. It's about mo'okua'ahau. It's about genealogy. And so what that means is, even me here in Spokane, I know that even as an indigenous person, I am also a foreigner to these lands. These are not the winds of my ancestors. I do not know the fish of these rivers and of these streams. I do not know these mountain peaks as I know my own. And so have a good sense of knowing of where you are and who you come from. And start there. And move very, very slowly and softly. And practice that. Practice listening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, I really appreciate your way of kind of spinning these things out into these poetic visions. So I guess to that end, I think a lot of people feel pretty bleak right now, mm-hmm. in some ways, and hope is kind of a strange concept to grapple with for a lot of folks. But what would be, in this work you do, you obviously do it because you believe in it, mm-hmm. And because it seems that you probably couldn't do anything else, mm-hmm. Which if that's not true, correct me, but there's a vibe that that's what you must do. What is your vision for, I guess, humanity moving forward through this time that we're in, into something beyond?
Yeah, you know, and I think when I think of the word hope, and then kind of what I gauged from the beginning was like a sense of hopelessness or like a loss of faith or hope in humanity, or in saving the planet, you know, and I got to spend a day yesterday with a young child from this area, and her grandmother spoke this morning at the gathering, and I said, we can't allow ourselves to lose hope, because the little ones are already, they're here. And I hate to say it, but when you feel sad and when you feel broken, you have to think of something bigger to pull you up, and you think of those little ones that are counting on you, whether or not you know it, whether or not you're ready. Their existence and those who are yet to be born demand that we rise. And so in thinking of hope and humanity, I'm dreaming of a more peaceful world. And what does that look like? And I was jotting some thoughts down this morning, and you know, and the women there, they talked about ovarian cancer and pollution, and a more peaceful world looks like clean water. Not only clean, but access to all, and free access and care for our water. It looks like the non-existence of corporations and big business and harmful governments that have forgotten their duties to protect and to serve the people. It looks like false leaders or people who think they are leaders being taken out of their positions of leadership, and those who know the waters and the oceans and the winds best, who know how to feed the people, those are the people who lead, the people who actually care, the people who serve. There's many. Anyway, I'm putting a poem together for the closing, and it's gonna be But what it really looks like is it looks like a climate of fear being met by a climate of love, regardless of what the situation looks like. And Uncle Jim, one of my mentors, he says, you know, just because you're a peace and justice and nonviolent activist or advocate, it doesn't mean that you're not gonna be met by violence. And so it looks like discipline in love, discipline in the kapu aloha to meet any and all circumstances where you could be greeted by violence with love. Can you do that?
Wow. And we just have a couple minutes left. I want to respect your time. And what else would you like to add? And if people want to get involved in any of the work that you do, if they want to learn more, where would you send them?
Yeah, if just like some small plugs, you can follow us on Facebook or on Instagram, or if you just Google Mauna Kea, Protect Mauna Kea, Pu'u Hulu Hulu. And so I would just go with Protect Mauna Kea because that's pretty basic. But there's different ways of at least learning and familiarizing yourself with the current and past activities and what we are asking for, what we're calling for. If you can donate, there's different sources to donate to for legal funds to support the efforts, ongoing efforts to protect our mountain. There's also, if you're a part of any group or university that is invested or not invested, you can submit letters of support to show solidarity in our requests for the protection of our mountain. So there's many different ways to help. And if you should feel called to go to the mountain, enter with respect, with love, and be in that mindset, and be open and ready to receive direction from those who are on the mountain.
Great. Yeah. Thank you so much for your work and your time.
Yes, thank you.
All right, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis here on KYRS. I'm your host, Taylor. That interview was with Loke Aloha, who is, as you heard, an indigenous person working in Mauna Kea to resist the telescope development that's happening there. I have some more resources that I'm going to share in the podcast notes for this show. Also, if you're just joining and you're like, wow, I wish I had heard the beginning of that wonderful interview, you can do that. I will podcast it this evening, and you can find that links to wherever you might get your podcasts at kyrs.org/show/praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S. I will share the link to the Pu'u Hulu Hulu page that she mentioned at the end. There's also some links and other stuff that you can find on my social media at Praxis Radio, PraxisRadio. I'm really glad that she was able to take the time to talk with me at the Vets for Peace conference. I did some more reading after the fact. She's done a lot. You know, there's people at the front lines, physically blocking the roads, doing a lot of like large scale protest stuff. But there's also kind of a, as there always is in this kind of work, a process of meetings and forums and studies. And Loke, or Ruth, is also has an archaeology background and has like submitted all of these kind of like formal reasons why this shouldn't be done. And I thought I would also share this short clip of Ruth at a public meeting at the end of July. This is on BigIslandVideoNews.com, so I'm borrowing it from them. And again, I'll post this link online, but I just wanted to share this short video of testimony. There's a lot more testimony. You can kind of see this is a well-documented struggle. So I'll post this link and it might send you down a whole new exploration of what's going on there in Hawaii and how you can support. So I'm going to play this quick clip.
All right, whoever's going first.
Identify. First time I met her in person.
Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Aloha mai kako. My name is Ruth Aloha. Mahalo to all of you. I actually count on you more than I count on anybody else because you guys see us. You live in our communities. Thank you to Matt. Thank you to all of you for being here. I want to acknowledge, so there's different things, 3 minutes. I'm going to try and wrap it. You don't need to accept it, but it needs to be put out for our keiki. I want to acknowledge what me or Harry Kim said. You know, and I was thinking, like, whenever I go in the kitchen at night, I flick on the light, and the roaches, as soon as they see the light, they run away. And that's the best metaphor I get for Harry Kim right now. That's the nicest way I get of putting it, right? So what does this statement ultimately represent? The justification, validation, and naturalization of violence through the use of false narratives for the care and support of Hawaiian culture and Kanaka Maoli. That's what it is, right? It's a false narrative that he's perpetuating, but I'm not worried because we're dismantling it and he's out of power. I want to acknowledge the three other speakers who came up before who also enforced settler mentality, mana'o thoughts. And the reason is whenever you try and advocate for the extinguishment of native rights, you're advocating for the extinguishment of native peoples. And that is problematic. And I hope they watch this video because they left too. I would have told them that. So we're talking about 12 years, yeah, budget cap, 12 years. I just came back from New Zealand attending NYSA, one of the largest indigenous gatherings, Native Peoples Conference. Every single person there stands with Mauna Kea. They made a vow to come and stand with us. So you
Excuse
will have.
Me. I'm sorry, she's testifying, please.
You will have 12 years. Now think about 12 years of people from all around the world, from every nation coming to Hawaii, and Hawaii is relying on the tourism industry. What will it look like when tourists start to stand on that mountain, when people stop coming? Because they said that they're gonna come, and this is really not for you folks, because I think you guys really care. I feel it, I see it in your eyes. But that's something, what is the financial estimate of that? I don't know if you have a way to think about that, but I would like to know how you're gonna arrest the whole world. The second one is death threats. I don't like to talk about this kind of stuff. This is stuff we talk about at home behind closed doors. We receive death threats. Activists go missing, we get killed. I'm smiling because I've accepted it. That's the fate, that's where we're at as humanity. We have to stand up for the water, for the mountain peaks, for Pohakuloa, because the next generation is counting on us. So if you choose to bite the bait that they need protection, then that means so do we. And that's why I'm putting it on the record. I have received death threats and so have other kia'i. So if you're gonna give them protection, we deserve it too. And another thing is provocateurs, if you never know, people like TMT, they plant them. They say, hey, you can call this guy, you can make one death threat. We could put him on the record. Why? So then we can make one case while we gotta beat up the protectors. So I just could give you a little bit of philosophy. You guys probably already know these things. Some of you guys have roots in activism. Mahalo. 30 seconds. Where can our money go? Our elders are being flown off island because we don't have adequate healthcare systems or expertise here. Our waiting rooms are being transformed into emergency rooms because we don't have enough space. Our UH Manoa professors are sleeping in their offices hiding because they don't get paid enough. They got PhD folks. We're telling our kids go to school. Our children are hungry. Our people are going houseless. We're sweeping them around like trash. We're treating soccer balls like they have more value than humans. Mahalo for your time. And mahalo, Miley and Karen, I've missed you. And greetings, mahalo. I'm from Kona. Mahalo.
Mahalo for your testimony.
So again, that was just a second video. It's from BigIslandVideoNews.com. I will post that link with the podcast. That was Ruth Aloha, who you heard in the interview just before that, testifying about when she's talking about the people disappearing like cockroaches at the beginning of that video. She's talking about the mayor, Harry Kim, and kind of the general way that this project has been welcomed by certain elements in Hawaiian formal leadership. So anyway, I just wanted to share that. It's a complex issue, but I am going to share all those links in the podcast notes and ways that people can contribute, amplify this struggle and all the rest. So there's also a really interesting article that I'm just going to share a tiny bit from that is from the Columbia Journalism Review that's talking about the news coverage of the resistance in Mauna Kea. And so Marissa Puryear put this together, and it's interviews with Native Hawaiians who have been part of this talking about the media coverage of it. So so she says, for years, coverage of Native Hawaiian resistance has portrayed the situation as a battle between science and religion, revealing the journalism field's severely misguided understanding of Native Hawaiian perspectives. Quote, the telescope builders have a strong claim to legitimacy, and they are being blamed for things they had nothing to do with, like the 1893 overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom, the loss of native lands, the state's many social ills, and degraded environment, end quote, wrote the New York Times editorial board in 2015. They continue, quote, this is an unfair burden for a group that has spent years cultivating local support, navigating the approval process, and successfully, so far, fending off lawsuits, end quote. After a decade of court battles, Hawaii Governor David Icke announced that TMT construction, that's 30-meter telescope, would commence in mid-July. Last week, activists engaged in nonviolent direct action aiming to halt the project. Their efforts have attracted a new round of international coverage, much of which has once more downplayed Native Hawaiians' range of concerns. In an op-ed for the Honolulu Civil Beat, columnist Tricia Kehulani Watson, who also serves on the board of directors for Aina Momona, a nonprofit dedicated to restoring Hawaiian sovereignty, considered opposition to the TMT alongside Kaho'olawe, an island used for decades as a U.S. military training ground and bombing range, now the subject of remediation and restoration efforts. Opposition to the TMT, wrote Watson, quote, has nothing to do with a telescope. She continued, it has everything to do with the enduring battle over Hawaii's future. The continued destruction of land and natural resources is short-sighted and fundamentally detrimental to the future generations who will one day live in these islands. The pattern of land mismanagement and natural resource abuse that the 30-meter telescope represents should concern everyone because it is not isolated to Mauna Kea. So this article goes on to interview specific activists about their concerns and kind of highlight this range of dissent to this project that, as this whole article points out, tends to get flattened into kind of a simplistic narrative in the media. So I will share that in the podcast notes and share all these links. If people have interesting stuff that they've found that you want to be included in that, you can email me Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S at KYRS.org, and I'd be happy to take a look and include it. So, yeah, I think that is all I have on Mauna Kea and the telescope. Thanks again to the Vets for Peace locally and to Loke Aloha for your time in doing that interview. Like I said, I have more interviews from that conference that I am excited to share in the near future. I wanted to shift gears into something related that has also been on the radar, probably a little more than telescope resistance this past week, which is fires in the Amazon. It's another example of something where the coverage has been sometimes misleading, sometimes flattened, both in mainstream media circles and also in lefty activist circles. So I'm going to try to just do a speed rundown of some of this coverage, talk about it, give you my take on it, which is just one of many, but also, again, as usual, share a big mess of links with you as well in the notes and at the end. So I found a few pretty good articles that get to some of the complexity of this issue. You might have seen a lot of things floating around. There's a lot of criticism flying around right now that various celebrities and even journalists have shared inaccurate images from different fires, images from 20 years ago, to share that the Amazon is being burned for agribusiness at a large scale, part of broader deforestation. So those criticisms of that, those inaccuracies, don't mean that the actual problem isn't happening. I think it's just a function of the way that we can get really carried away with social media and with stories like this becoming, you know, viral so quickly, and we can just kind of distribute things on without thinking. But this is a really good article just from a couple days ago. Robinson Meyer wrote at The Atlantic that talks about the context of the larger deforestation crisis and the way it hasn't been started under Bolsonaro, the fascistic new president of Brazil, but that his policies have accelerated it. So I'm just going to read some from this article and again link to it in the notes. He says, the Amazon is burning. There have been more than 74,000 fires across Brazil this year and nearly 40,000 fires across the Amazon, according to Brazil's National Institute for Space Research. That's the fastest rate of burning since record keeping began in 2013. So I'm going to digress out of this, which is, it's interesting that it's said that way. That specific record keeping began in 2013, but there's actually a fairly detailed record of burning and deforestation through the 20th century that exists as well. So skipping forward in this same article, the fires have captured the planet's attention as little else does. The Amazon is the world's largest and most diverse tract of rainforest, with millions of species and billions of trees. It stores vast amounts of planet-warming carbon dioxide and produces 6% of the planet's oxygen. So the Amazonian fires, which have been blazing for weeks and notoriously received less coverage than Notre Dame's burning roof, seem like a potent symbol of humanity's indifference to environmental disorder, including climate change. But climate change is not the primary cause of the wildfires. Unlike, say, most California blazes, which are sparked by accident and then intensified by climate change, the Amazonian fires are not wildfires at all. These fires did not start by lightning strike or power line. They were ignited. And while they largely affect land already cleared for ranching and farming, they can and do spread into old growth forest. The scariest two numbers for understanding the fires are this. There are 80% more fires this year than there were last summer, according to the Brazilian government. This surge in burning has accompanied a spike in deforestation in general. More than 1,330 square miles of the Amazon rainforest have been lost since January, a 39% increase over the same period last year, according to the New York Times. Why are these figures so important? Because Brazil's political leadership has changed in the past year. On January 1st, Jair Bolsonaro, a far-right populist who has openly pined for his country's authoritarian past, was sworn in as president. During his campaign, he promised to weaken the Amazon's environmental protections, which have been effective at reducing deforestation for the past two decades, and open up the rainforest to economic development. Now he is making good on that promise. The three Brazilian states with the worst spikes in fire this year are all governed by Bolsonaro's allies, according to Richard Black, a former BBC journalist and the current director of the nonprofit Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit. The states governed by Bolsonaro's political opponents have actually seen a decline in fires. And according to allegations by the global news site Open Democracy, leaked documents show that Bolsonaro's government intends to strategically present conservation projects in the Amazon. So that's all of that article I'm going to share with you, but I'll put the link in the notes. You can email me for it. It's published in The Atlantic just 2 days ago by Robinson Meyer. Just focusing again on the political accelerations of this. One thing I want to point out within that article that was just kind of a throwaway in there, but I think is an important fact to get straight when we're talking about this. I've seen a lot of, you know, this idea that the Amazon is the lungs of the earth. And I've seen a lot of wild statistics like that the Amazon produces 20% of Earth's oxygen or something like that. It's actually 6%, but it does have this incredible ecological value, not only as a home to 1 in 10 of all known species on the earth, 10% of everyone living on the earth lives there, which is pretty important in and of itself, obviously. But it, as it's deforested, the carbon that's been stored by the rainforest is released and it throws off its balance, its former status, I guess, as a carbon sink. So without getting too far into science that's out of my depth, that's what I will say about that. There is someone who is more in their depth talking about the science of this. Science journalist Matt Simon. This is another piece that's just been published this last week or two that I will share on Wired, the horrifying science of the deforestation fueling Amazon fires. So I'm going to, again, just share like selectively from this article too. He says, since the 1970s, 20% of the Amazon has been deforested, totaling about twice the area of California. But deforestation isn't an organized shrinking of the rainforest, paring it down from the edges in. Humans carve out farmlands, sometimes leaving a neat edge where the forest meets the fields, or even creating islands of forests surrounded by crops or grazing fields for cattle. Indeed, agriculture is far and away the primary driver of deforestation in Brazil. You might think that, well, things could be worse. At least these can operate like actual islands, self-contained spots of green in a sea of agriculture. And you wouldn't be alone. Quote, people used to think an island was just a miniature version of the Amazon, says University of Florida ecologist Emilio Bruna, who studies the area. Quote, so if you had an area of the Amazon that had a jaguar, and you had an area that's 10 times bigger, you'd have X more jaguars because of their territory size. But it turns out that when you isolate a fragment of rainforest, things get a lot more complicated. Like on a real island, animals on an Amazon island can't flee to other islands. They're trapped. Even birds, which are more than capable of leaving, have evolved to live in the dense rainforest and may have become behaviorally averse to crossing open areas where predators might lurk. Meanwhile, the edges are closing in on the species of a rainforest island. Deep in the Amazon, it's dark and cooler and humid, with the multitudinous trees dominating the climate. At the edge of a rainforest island, though, humidity plummets and temperatures skyrocket. Decomposition rates fall as fungi retreat, causing dead foliage to pile up as tinder and new kinds of trees proliferate at the edges. Quote, all the big ones start to get stressed out hydrologically and die, and then they keel over and open up a giant hole in the canopy, end quote, says Bruna. Pioneer species get in there, which have lower density wood and therefore sequester less carbon. Quote, you change the composition of the Amazon and get lots of local extinctions from that spot. So, again, I'm just sharing part of this and I will share the link. The reason I want to highlight it is because I think we have a real tendency in our culture in general to oversimplify these things and to not fully understand the context. And when I say this culture, I mean the culture of industrial civilization under capitalism, that, you know, has spread through the world and is fueling the business model that is fueling this deforestation and this shift from rainforest into organized farmland, either for cattle grazing or for soy production. Those are kind of the two main reasons this is happening. So I just think that it's important to remember that these things have ripple effects. It isn't as simple as we want this kind of land to turn into this other kind of land so that we can make this product and make money. There are all these cascading effects. And when we're looking at climate change, when we're looking at climate science, this is the main issue, is that you can't just pull one thread out and have it be the only thing that's affected. And going back to the beginning of the show, Loke Aloa's interview and what she shared about science and indigenous people all being scientists, the more we look at these climate issues, the more we need to look back and consult indigenous people and have indigenous people lead, because in fact, like, those are the people who understand how to thrive on a planet in a way that our system has utterly failed to do. So that's what I'll say about that, because I'm running low on time. The final piece that I wanted to share from closes on that note that I was just talking about. It's very long, but it's a fascinating read that really focuses on the indigenous resistance to this farming development, the forest communities who are on the front line here. And it's Alexander Zaitchik's piece. It's in The Intercept. It's called Rainforest on Fire. And sorry, I was scrolling. That's why I said it that way. it's a long form piece, and I'm just going to read a little bit of it for you and then share the link. So he's talking and mostly focusing in this article with the Aparina people in Brazil's southwestern Amazon. He says the Aparina were gathered to discuss the emergency. In recent years, outlaws with chainsaws, known as land grabbers, locusts, have been cutting deeper into Brazil's indigenous territories and other protected forests throughout the Amazon. Emboldened by the October election of Jair Bolsonaro as Brazil's president, they are pushing more brazenly into places like Aparina land in the roadless depths of Amazonas, the country's biggest state and home to the world's largest standing tracts of unbroken rainforest. Quote, with Bolsonaro, the invasions are worse and will continue to get worse, said Francisco Umanari, a 42-year-old Aparina chief. His project for the Amazon is agribusiness. Unless he is stopped, he'll run over our rights and allow a giant invasion of the forest. The land grabs are not new, but it's become a question of life and death. So then he describes the meetings that have happened, the witness of these people who are of this land, just coming into an area to find it completely cleared nearly overnight and organizing what to do about that. I'm just going to read some of the closing of this interview because I think it wraps a lot of things up in a very tidy way. I have to scroll the right part. So this is the closing of that same article. In early May, a few weeks after Melo de Lima boasted to me about ranching's expansion into Amazonas, the United Nations disturbed the world with the findings of a landmark report on biodiversity. Produced by experts across dozens of disciplines, it concluded that only, quote, transformative change could prevent the looming extinction of 1 million plant and animal species. These million coal mine canaries, dropping to the floors of degraded and fragmented rainforests and floating to the surfaces of overfished and acidifying oceans, foretold a wider disintegration in the web of life that threatens the, quote, very foundations of our economy's livelihoods, food security, health, and quality of life worldwide. The call for transformative change was no echo of familiar appeals to somehow green the endless growth that is programmed into the genes of industrial consumer civilization. Quote, we mean a fundamental system-wide reorganization across technological, economic, and social factors, including paradigms, goals, and values, end quote, said Robert Watson, the British atmospheric chemist who chaired the UN panel. As for where humanity should look for help and inspiration during this difficult civilizational pivot, the report urges the, quote, full and effective participation of indigenous peoples in developing systems of environmental governance informed by their, quote, knowledge, innovations, and practices, institutions, and values. This is the fruit of a delayed but deepening dialogue between Occidental science and indigenous cultures. After decades of watching from the margins, indigenous groups have moved close to the center of the ring at global environmental and conservation summits, in tandem with a wave of research that backs up their historical claims to being the forest's most natural and effective protectors. Last November, an Amazonian delegation delivered a document, the Bogota Declaration, to the 14th UN Biodiversity Conference held in the Egyptian coastal city of Sharm el-Sheikh. It outlined a plan devised by 400 ethnic groups across the basin to establish a sacred corridor of life of contiguous indigenous territories reaching from the Andes to the Atlantic. Inside the 500 million acre stretch of rainforest, indigenous nations would pool their ancestral knowledge and showcase alternative modes of development and ways of living. The declaration described the proposal as, quote, a first step to guaranteeing the existence of all forms of life on the planet. So, again, this piece is from The Intercept. It's called Rainforest on Fire by Alexander Zaitchik, and I will share the link to it in the podcast notes along with everything else I shared today. If you're just joining me at the end of the hour and you want to hear the great interview from the beginning or any of the rest of the show, you can find it on the podcast later this evening. searching Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, anywhere you get your podcasts, or by going directly to kyrs.org/show/praxis. I'll be back next week with a brand new show. Thanks for listening. You're listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.